you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson on the show. Dr. Johnson completed his doctorate at the University of Nebraska in 1999, University of Nebraska, Lincoln. He focused on anti-modernist social philosophy. He is a former professor of both history and political science at the University of Nebraska. Since 1999, he has been the editor and a contributor, researcher to the Barnes Review, a revisionist journal of European history. Dr. Johnson is the author of several books, including The Third Rome, Holy Russia, Tsarism and Orthodoxy, Russian Populists, The Political Thought of Vladimir Putin. His latest book is The Soviet Experiment, Challenging the Apologists for Communist Tyranny. His website is The Russian Orthodox Medievalist, The Russian Orthodox Medievalist at www.russjournal.org. Dr. Johnson, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well, my friend. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Was all that accurate?
At Nebraska, I was doing my dissertation when I was teaching.
Okay, I see.
So, but I was professor at Mount St. Mary's, briefly at Penn State, Mount Alto, the other campus of Mount St. Mary's, PHCC here near Pittsburgh, and online in a few places. So, you know, I've been all over the place.
Oh, okay. So you are now no longer in academia, but you're still still teaching, more or less.
I'm always an academic. I don't know how to think in any other way. I've been fired from more than one academic position, I'm very proud to say, having nothing to do with my ability. It had everything to do with, we all know why. I guess assigning Alfred Rosenberg's The Myth of the 20th Century in your 20th Century History class can be a problem. And that's what happened in my case. I had an excellent record. You know, students loved me. My student evaluations were extraordinary. Now, I'd have the radio show, the Orthodox Nationalist, which is a huge success for some reason, even though it's nothing but lectures from me, absolutely nothing else. On Radio Aryan, I have the Thursday slot with Savannah Longshanks talking about international politics. I translate sometimes for some extra money. Book sales, articles. I do legal research on the side on occasion, and that's enough. Really, you know, I don't need very much. That's enough for me to make a living, and I'm quite happy with it.
Keeps your plate full, so to speak, right?
You could be an academic without being in academia. It's hard to do, but I've pulled it off, and that's one of my great accomplishments.
Well, tonight I read this short book. It's a long essay, A Circle of Betrayal, Cowardice and Deceit, on the 100th anniversary of the ritual murder of the Russian royal family. This book, well, I'll read a synopsis. This is one of the many defenses of the Russian monarchy by Matthew Raphael Johnson, one of the most controversial Russia scholars in the Anglo-American world. The reign of Tsar Nicholas was an unmitigated success. The destruction of the Romanov house in 1918 radically altered the course of cosmic history in ways beyond description. By keeping oligarchy in check, Russia exploded into the 20th century as one of its most powerful agricultural, military, and industrial powers. The war was engineered by Britain to ensure her two great rivals, Germany and Russia, fought one another rather than combine forces. The result was the utter domination of liberalism and Marxism the world over. So this book is it's about a lot more than just the royal family. It's about the course of history in the 20th century. It's a critique of liberalism, democracy, sort of the modern world, which is more or less Freemasonry writ large. So I'll let you get into this. Let's talk about Tsar Nicholas II. You started out with an introduction about the 17 points I thought were interesting, but I'll let you get into how you want to introduce this to our audience.
Well, for those who don't know, almost everything that the average educated American believes about the world is pure fantasy. Western peoples live in a bubble. When I taught myself Russian about 15 years ago, that opened to me a whole new set of literature that I never knew before, a whole new point of view that most of us have no access to. I uncovered things that, you know, that absolutely shocked me. I wrote The Third Rome back when I was a young man with two babies in the house. Would have been done much sooner if it wasn't for the two babies. Because your average historical work on old Russia is awful. It's bad. People don't realize that no one knew anything about Russia in the United States until after World War II. If you wanted to learn Russian, you had to go to Harvard. There's only one or two places that even taught it. It was a huge black spot on American life. In American thinking, most people thought that they were, like, you know, half Mongol, that they're that they were civilized by Vikings, that all these myths and stories that they were uncivilized, and a lot of that comes from the British propaganda machine, especially starting in the Crimean War in the 19th century, in the reign of Nicholas I. And Great Britain was the enemy, and still is to this day, of the Russian Empire. In the second half of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th, Russia was an incredibly successful place economically. By the time the war broke out, depending on who you read, between 94 and 96% of the land was owned by the peasantry, either in a communal form or individually. The debt was extremely low. The state was very small. You know, the number of government workers per 100,000 people in 1913 was 163, which is the lowest in Europe. Tsar Nicholas the himself was a great ascetic, was a strong Orthodox man. So, for example, when the new uniforms were issued for the Russian army, he needed to wear it himself. He said, "I need to wear this." And he did a 20-mile march with a full pack to make sure that his soldiers would be comfortable with it. And this is what kind of man he was. He was very decisive. He hated war. In fact, during World War I, Russia was the least mobilized of all the powers, only 39% of all men aged 15 to 49. But in Germany, it was 81%. The lowest number of prisoners per 100,000 people. The lowest number of mental illness per 100,000 people. The amount of taxes per person was twice as low as France and Germany, four times lower than Britain. They had a huge trade surplus. Because they wouldn't allow a Rothschild central bank, the ruble was extremely strong. It was the most stable currency in the world, the gold ruble in particular. They had conquered illiteracy by the time World War I began. From 1890 to 1913, the Russian GDP grew 400%. They discovered oil, and actually this was a, you know, and the British are looking at this, panicked, because Germany, of course, is going through the same massive development at the same time. Two strongly popular authoritarian governments are blowing England away. And when the Russians discovered oil in the Caucasus Mountains, that was it. That was the last straw. The Russian population was going through the roof, and of course, they had nothing but land. You know, if you wanted land, you get land for free. If you wanted to go to the east, southern Siberia, which is very, very fertile. Per capita alcohol consumption in Russia was the second lowest in the world. Only Norway was lower. Russia led the world in labor productivity and national income, you know, all things considered at the time. No problems with inflation or unemployment, and full freedom of the press, which was, you know, abused at the time. It's a myth, of course, that they're – well, let me put it this way. The old myth is that Russia wasn't, you know, World War I, they didn't have rifles or anything else, and that's a story. It's not true. Initially, no one believed that the war was going to be as violent as it was. World War I shocked everybody. And all the problems with mobilization and supplies, it occurred with every country in the war. Russia was no different. They recovered in about a year. Of course, Russia has a problem, much, much more land to cover, worse weather and mud and everything else is a huge problem. Tsar Nicholas is one of the most respected men in Europe at the time. But he spoke 10 languages. He was one of the great leaders of the late 19th century. But when the white government took over in 1917, of course, and the Bolsheviks in 1921, both the Reds and the British began a campaign against him that was – and, of course, during World War I itself, the Germans engaged in a campaign against him and against Rasputin to paint him in the worst possible colors. But unfortunately, that stuck. Getting rid of Tsar Nicholas was getting rid of an inconvenience. He was, you know, he saw himself as the last of the Roman emperors. He knew that he was going to die this way. He said it many times in his diaries. But he said, this is okay. This is what martyrdom is. He knew this was going to happen. The man was extraordinary. And there's no question about it that, and by the way, the title of the book, Cowardice and Deceit, that's right out of Nicholas's diary. He didn't abdicate the throne. That's a forgery. Again, everything people think about the Tsar and about Russia, really most things really, is completely false. When I was studying Burma, the Burmese military government, which is always kind of a hobby of mine, I discovered a law of social science, and I named it after myself. Johnson's law states that the more obscure the country or region, the more the media is going to lie about it, because they can get away with it. Too few people can contradict it. The more the media is going to make mistakes because they're too ignorant about it, and there's really no one to tell them any different. There's no reason to do due diligence when, you know, no one really knows anything. And that's the case in places like Burma, Afghanistan, Iran, and it's certainly the case in 19th century Russia. The murder of Tsar Nicholas changed the world entirely and in the worst possible way. The Constantine line, starting from St. Constantine, ended, and the world entered into a chaos that is still going on today.
Now, you offer the beginning of it. You have a thing to say about monarchy and versus monarchy versus democracy. Basically how monarchy, democracy in republicanism is Freemasonic, and it's a facade or a front for oligarchy. And a monarchy like one that existed in Russia was sort of a defense mechanism against these oligarchic tendencies that tend to afflict all democratic, supposedly democratic societies.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are no democracies. I mean, there's no country that functions by majority rule or nothing else. Republican systems come from the overthrow of the earlier monarchy, the killing of the king ritual, where the sons, and this is, again, and this is an archetype, the sons envy the father, want his power, kill him, but they don't have the legitimacy of the father. They divide up the spoils amongst themselves, but the father was the man who had the legitimacy, the right to rule. So that means, knowing that they have no right to rule, they have to manipulate people. This comes straight out of the Renaissance, the Medici clan, their rule over Florence. The killing of the king ritual is detailed in Freud's Civilization and Discontent and a few other places, like the Golden Bough. And so ultimately it comes down to defending oligarchy or creating an oligarchy. That's what a republican system is. It's where elites meet together occasionally to divide up the spoils and make sure that no one knows this. When the Medici banking clan took over Florence, and Machiavelli actually talks about this at some length, he says that they needed to maintain the old system, at least the trappings of the old system. They couldn't rule openly. No one wants to be ruled by bankers. So they maintained the old constitutional rhetoric. They had, you know, the old traditional stuff in urban politics in Florence, but of course they ran everything. And that became the model of republics the world over. This wasn't, you know, I mean, the U.S. was a different story. I was always an anti-federalist. The anti-federalists, when I first read them, I taught a whole class at the University of Nebraska on the anti-federalists. They didn't like the Constitution very much. They thought it would lead to oligarchy. They predicted everything that we suffer with today. But the United States was a confederation. It was never a nation. It was a confederation of different regions and peoples with a very weak central government. It wouldn't even feel to have a standing army. And so to some extent, early on, it was not an oligarchy. It was too big and it was too sparsely populated for that. But in Europe, the republican system is derived from the killing of the king, and they have to rule by manipulation. The U.S. today, of course, is the ultimate. It is like the most extraordinary oligarchy that ever existed. Everything is based on illusion and smoke and mirrors. You know, authoritarian leaders of the past would love to have a major media where even though they're in private hands, they all say the same thing all the time on issues that are important of importance. Secret meetings like the Bilderbergs. I mean, this is well known, yet it doesn't make an impact on the public. You know, getting, you know, pulling off false flags and stuff like that. This is how the ruling class rules. And I think right now they're in a state of panic. But in a system like you had, and the best example always was the opposite, was under Tsar Nicholas in Russia. He maintained his popularity. And one of the ways the British, then later the Germans, the Masons, of course, loathed him, wanted to attack him was using Rasputin. They couldn't attack him directly. It was in bad taste, and they would be hated for that. So they invented this fictional character. I mean, Rasputin existed, but what they said about him was purely fiction. And that's how they attacked him. It's always manipulation. It's always creating an image. I've worked on many political campaigns in this country since I was 18, and no one cares about the truth or ruling well. It's all about how do we get a message out? How do we fool people? How do we get people to think in different ways, to need things they don't really need, or to want things they don't really need? And, you know, the Russian monarchy, as well, I think the German monarchy as well at the time, proved that liberalism was a fraud, that non-liberal governments could do better. Russian and German factory legislation and the welfare system were far superior to anything in Great Britain. And they didn't need a liberal democracy for this. And so ideologically, as well as economically and militarily, Russia and Germany were to the British liberals an absolute insult, just like Russia and China are to the Americans today. And that's really the issue.
And this is why in the late 19th, early 20th century, Halford McKinder developed, well, the McKinder Doctrine, that in order to control the world, Eurasia was the pivot of world control, they had to control what transpired in Eurasia, and that would ultimately mean getting Germany and Russia to fight each other, to bring each other down, so no, they wouldn't unify or work together, and therefore the sea power could maintain global dominance.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. Of course, Alexander Dugin and the Eurasianist movement, I'm very sympathetic with. I've translated some of Dugin's stuff that's, you know, I mean, most of Dugin's stuff is not in English. You mentioned Mackinder. The Eurasian plain is such a gigantic area. It covers, and of course, now the Silk Road Initiative is throwing the Western world into a panic because it will be wealthy. It will be successful. It's already being successful. The control of those energy resources is absolutely essential. And this explains the war between the U.S. and Russia. I mean, let's be clear, there were never any sanctions on the USSR. No matter how many people they murdered, no matter how great the gulag became, and it wasn't dismantled until the 80s, American capitalists traded with them. The early Soviet economy was built by the West. Man. They didn't have the technicians or the ability or the material to do it. Their electrical grid was laid by GE. Their oil was pumped by the Rockefellers and, you know, Amoco.
This is long before Lend-Lease.
This is before Lend-Lease, yes.
So you couldn't make World War II as the excuse, yeah.
Well, this is, and of course they fought on the same side in World War II, which Hitler could not believe. The mining was done from a large mining company from Alaska. Henry Ford built the largest Ford plant in the world in eastern Ukraine in 1936, and that became the standard for all Soviet automotives and trucks, and U.S. Steel built their steel. They invested massive amounts of money during the Great Depression, mind you, in the Soviet Union. They built it. In fact, Stalin at one point said that we're losing our independence because of this massive influx of Western capital. It's the greatest open secret of the 20th century. Anthony Sutton has a 3-volume set from the Hoover Institute showing this in great detail. This isn't a matter of opinion. This is simply how it was. So the West created the USSR. There was never any sanctions on them. There was never any. As soon as someone like Putin comes in, all of a sudden it's a problem. All of a sudden, Russians are bad again. The Cold War is largely a myth, but the war between the U.S. and Russia is no myth. The U.S. has Putin surrounded, and I don't think Putin. I think, you know, the U.S. military is a paper tiger, has been proven over and over again. Overthrowing sympathetic governments, which is always very unpopular. You know, the U.S. is doing everything in its power, and the ridiculous Russiagate crap, which just shocks me just because of its stupidity. You know how, you know, this is all they come up with. You know, none of this was possible in the Soviet Union. The ruling class in the U.S. had no problem. The government's different. Ruling classes and governments are different. The ruling class in the U.S. profited from the USSR and hated any kind of Cold War. You know, during the Vietnam War, of course, Americans are being killed, and every major corporation in America is trading with the Soviet Union. And some of this stuff, of course, went to the North Vietnamese. It's absurd. As far as the ruling class is concerned, the Soviet Union and the U.S. were never enemies. They only became enemies when the oligarchs were chased out of Russia by Putin. That's what the difference is. The Communist Party of the Soviet Union controlled everything. That means they owned everything. These men were the wealthiest men in the world because they controlled every square inch of economic production in the Soviet Union. I've said many times before, when Trotsky was murdered, it was discovered that he had huge bank accounts in Geneva and in New York City. He was a billionaire, as all these guys were.
And
it was all a fraud.
It's important to point out that the personal fortune of the Tsar never exceeded $4 million, right?
As far as anyone can tell, that's the highest. And he gave most of that away for the war effort. When the war broke out, the royal family, the women of the royal family, took a crash course in nursing and rushed to the front. And they were, as I was said at the time, were the absolute bravest. They didn't care for their own safety. In fact, some of the girls had to be told to take a rest because they were developing heart problems. the constant stress and lack of sleep. This is what they did. The London banking clans said, where they had it mostly invested there, about 4 million rubles. But by the time the war ended, it was all gone. And again, that was because he was personally sending money to families of dead soldiers, creating all kinds of nursing homes and things like that for wounded men, and all kinds of charity work. Charity of the royal family was extraordinary. He didn't die a wealthy man, but the people who killed him were all quite wealthy.
Now, we get into the, of course, the revolution. We will talk about the upheavals in 1905 following the Russo-Japanese War, which was fomented by the United States, particularly one Jacob Schiff, but also the how the revolution, particularly the Bolsheviks, were funded by the West. And then we can get into, perhaps, when you talk about the ritualistic nature of the killing of the Tsar, who was particularly responsible. There seemed to be an ethno-religious element to this, because the people who perpetrated the crime were all part of the same tribe. Do you want to get into that?
There were Hindus, yeah.
Amish?
There were Buddhists. A coincidence that would.
But the murder itself, I mean, obviously we have the story where I think Katzenberg, I think where it occurred in July 1918. The excuse was the whites were approaching, the Czech battalion was nearby, so Lenin ordered the killing, although there's no paper trail. It just occurred. But I've heard it said that the orders came out of New York and London. Is there any truth to that?
Well, there's a lot of truth to it. The Reds, you know, let's be clear. The white armies were the armies defending the revolutionary government of Kerensky. That, was, of course, was overthrown in 1921, where the Civil War started. The biggest problem with the white armies was that they had no ideological unity. They had far more men. They had the best commanders by far. They had access to the old royal treasury. So they had more money, at least on hand. And yet they never got a dime, a penny, a bullet from the West. This is one of the many myths about the war. The West was in favor of a Red victory. Now remember, no one in the U.S. knew what a Bolshevik was. This was a completely foreign word. I've read all the American media at the time, and these were idiots. They had no idea what they were talking about. They referred to the Cossacks as Apaches because they had the top knot. They didn't know what else to call them. They were so ignorant about the situation. And again, it's Johnson's law here. No one knew any better, so they could write pretty much whatever they want. And it was uniformly hostile to the monarchy. And they created this myth that the White Army was a royalist army. Now, of course, there were royalist elements within it. But it was the army that was loyal to the government of Kerensky, the white, so-called white government. And the ideological statement was that, well, as soon as we win, we're going to create a constituent assembly and we're going to solve all these problems. Well, no one is going to die for a constituent assembly. They want to be inspired. The Reds were absolute brilliant tacticians. They didn't have the men. I mean, Trotsky was the head of the Red Army. He had no military experience, God knows. But the fact is that the communist ideology, both in its exoteric and esoteric versions, was extremely rigid. Dissenters were shot. There was a set of slogans, a set of ideas, a view of history, very specific. And they told people that as soon as we win, we're going to give you title to land, which, by the way, they had under Tsar Nicholas anyway. Control over all industry. It's going to be a worker state, religious freedom, all this kind of thing. And, of course, they didn't mean a word of it. Peace, land, and bread was their slogan. Well, God knows the continuous revolution doesn't want anything to do with peace. They collectivized all land, and very little bread was produced. So it was a ridiculous slogan designed only to insult Russians. Trotsky hated the Russian peasantry. The Bolshevik leadership was Jewish, well off, and usually from the merchant classes or professional classes, and completely urban and Jewish. This is what they were. and they knew nothing about the peasantry, and they hated them. They knew that they would never support the Soviet Union, which is true. And because the West was sending so much food aid in, they didn't really need them to grow anything. And during the Civil War, there was a collapse in production. And ultimately, when the Reds won, they created the new economic policy to create some kind of a market system, which did nothing more than expose who the successful peasants were, who then were eventually murdered. But so long as the West was pumping food aid into the country, saving the Soviet Union time after time after time, they should never have won anything. They were a small group at first. But as soon as you win a few battles, all of a sudden everyone's on your side. As far as the West was concerned, Woodrow Wilson and his clique, all they knew was the Reds wanted a very strong centralized state to serve as a buffer against Germany. That's all they knew. The media was reporting the whites were monarchists and anti-Semites, which is the worst thing you could possibly be, and so they were condemned over and over again. There was at no time any aid offered or given to the whites. You know, I've read the diaries of all the major white generals. They all say the same thing. Now, as far as the execution is concerned, the house that they were murdered in, they were kept in for a while. It's called the Pontiff House. I wanted to reproduce the picture of the writing on the wall, but I couldn't. I couldn't find anything good enough that had the better quality I could use for that. It was too blurry. What's kept out of the history books is that the real owner of the house was Jacob Gelfand, a Jewish gold merchant. Now, the room where they were murdered, they were brought down to the basement. They were humiliated the whole time they were there. You know, the girls were very attractive. There's no doubt in my mind. They took liberties with them. The first thing that strikes you when you look at the old pictures is the Hebrew letter Lamed. As I've written in this book, it refers to the heart. But the heart often in Egypt referred to the king. The Egyptians believed that the heart was a source of thought other than the brain. And it was the destruction of the heart, destruction of the heart of the king. And I mentioned in the book, too, that the double Lamed in Arabic refers to a man being torn to pieces. So, but the hanged man, you know, it also refers, as I mentioned here, the 12th card of the tarot deck. The 12th card of the tarot deck is often interpreted as a revolutionary card, a turning point, beliefs turned upside down. So when you translate it all, it comes down to this is a sacrifice of the king bringing about the destruction of his kingdom. And then through secret forces, the Tsar has been offered in sacrifice so that his country be destroyed. All peoples are informed of this event. Now, that's my translation, but that's a very common one of what was done. Those slogans have been used elsewhere, by the way. I don't know if I mentioned it in the book or not, but there were a few high-profile assassinations of British agents in Israel that use the exact same kind of language. Not mentioning king, of course, or whatever. But and I also mentioned that the operation, I mean, it came from the top. You know, there is no paperwork that survived. But of course, this was this is warfare. It was called Operation Chimney Sweep. And now, why would they use that name? Well, as Michael Hoffman has taught us many times, the chimney sweep was, you know, a form of really child slavery in early modern Britain, really 19th century Britain, early 20th century Britain. Really the sacrifice of children for the sake of industrialization. And so there's no question this was a ritual killing. They realized that, and you're right, you know, the White Army was on the borders of Ekaterinburg. And I also mentioned, I do believe that the name of the town is important. It was named after Empress Catherine II, who murdered her husband, Tsar Peter III. She didn't even speak Russian. You know, so this is something, but, you know, they also want to tell us that the Tsar was discredited and unpopular, and yet, you know, why kill him then? If he was discredited and unpopular, who cares? Now, royalist groups within Russia were trying to raise money. They raised a few hundred thousand rubles plea to ransom him. They said no. These groups, as well as many politicians, went to the British and said, will you take him? And they said no. So there's no question that the British were involved in this. And this is why you're correct in asking it. This was a London-New York thing. The British could have rescued him with no problem.
And he's the cousin of the British king.
That's right. And they look very alike. Have you ever seen the two of them together? Mm-hmm. They're almost identical. No question. They're related, and they knew that they could rescue him, and they knew by saying no that they condemned him. So there's no question that they knew about what was going to happen, and so they're very much complicit in this. Actually, the only person who went to these people and tried to have them released was a German ambassador. He was the only guy. You know, so there's a lot of – this is never mentioned anywhere – a lot of activity in Russia. Royalists knew what was going to happen to him. And they – the German ambassador was the only guy of any of the elites that were in Petersburg at the time. They had moved the capital a bit later, who asked for his release. But the British couldn't have saved him, and they refused. So there was no doubt they're complicit. There's no question about it.
And, of course, you know, it wasn't just the Tsar who was killed. It was a massacre. His wife, the Tsarina, the Tsarevich, the heir to the throne, the son, and the and his daughters, along with, I guess, three assistants?
And the dog.
And the dog. Okay.
They got to kill the dog. I don't know what the hell the dog did. And by all accounts, you know, the girls took a long time to die. There is no doubt they were raped, no doubt in my mind. I think Anastasia was wearing a metal icon, and one of the bullets in a low-caliber gun didn't quite penetrate, so they had to shoot her several times. It took them a while to die. And they could have just shot him in the head, but they didn't. So they were tortured to death. There's no question.
And, of course, the slow death, the viciousness of it, is part of the ritual aspect of it, or just sort of revenge?
Well, you know, I mentioned in this book too, the pogroms were all mythology. They didn't happen. The first one to say that mentioned this was Oleg Platonov in Russia, and then Solzhenitsyn in his 200 years together. And I use both of them as sources. At the time, none of them were translated into English. But they believed, as did all people in the West, that the Tsar ordered killings of Jews in the Western Empire, which is laughable, ridiculous. These were the economic centers of the whole country. Chaos there was in nobody's. But this was the revenge factor of it. You know, they wanted to believe this.
Yeah, because a lot of the emigres coming to the United States had stories to this day in their families about oppression in Russia. It's sort of a staple now, part of the mythology of that time.
That's right. And these became the neocons. And so many of them were from this very emigre generation, Jewish emigre generation. The pogroms is something that's worth discussing. You know, the big ones, you remember, there were no gun laws.
Is it illegal to question the pogroms?
I don't know. I don't know. It's a funny question. You know, I think in places like Germany and Great Britain, I think they could probably make a case for it.
Okay. I'm sorry.
And by the way, let me get this out of the way. There are no Holocaust denial laws in Russia. I'm sick and tired of that mythology. It's not true. There's an extremist law on the books. There's a law about questioning the Red – which is weird – questioning the Red Army, their behavior during World War II. Mm-hmm. Nothing had to do with the Holocaust. There was a case, and I did a whole broadcast on this and an article on this, where a man from the Perm region, which had been taken over by the Shabbat sect, by the way, he was one of their big enemies, was publishing, you know, Holocaust literature, anti-Holocaust literature on his site, and he was arrested based on this extremist law. And he was acquitted on the grounds that scholarly interest – and this stuff could never be state controlled. Now, the extremist law was passed in Russia under Medvedev, really against the Muslims. It really has to do with these groups getting most of their funding from abroad. That's what the NGO law is all about.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to permit organizations in the country that are financed from outside. They're enemy aliens. And the right to do this.
Same with Scientology, things like that, yeah.
Well, you've heard about some of that. Yeah, they've kicked out some of the Christian scientists.
Yeah.
Because the children that they've let die. And there was a huge outpouring of contempt for them in Russia. And so they threw them out. And this is why Russia is you know, the greatest place in the world ideologically right now. As difficult as it is, economically speaking. But, you know, Putin did throw out the worst of the oligarchs. He replaced them with a new ruling class coming from the security services and the army. And people sometimes forget, in the 1990s, Russia almost disappeared. There was no functioning state. There was no functioning tax collection. There was no real military chain of command, which explains the debacle in Chechnya, which, of course, Putin ended. It was an absolute disaster. The lifespan of the average Russian went down to 56.
Mm-hmm.
By 1997.
And it was going on in the Caucasus was a NATO CIA operation too.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, the Israelis were involved in it just like they were with the color revolution in Georgia. Mm-hmm. In fact, the defense minister was an Israeli. So yeah, just to answer your question, yeah, the revenge part of it, no question, comes from these myth. Oh, and don't forget, I have a whole paper out on all the New York Times headlines saying that they killed 6 million Jews.
Yeah, this was the first 6 million, right?
It's not. I mean, 6 million goes way back.
Yeah.
But the first time that the press used it,
mm-hmm.
over and over again. I mean, I have the actual clippings. PDFs of the actual clippings. 6 million are being killed, or 6 million are being held captive. Something, that number comes up over and over again. 600. The number 6 is the most important. Yeah. 600,000. It doesn't. You know, the numerology only is just the one number. 1 to 9. And so this is the first time. Yeah, they're slaughtering Jews for no reason, and there's camps and everything else. This is the first time that comes up. That's right.
And I don't think the royal family was ever accused of having lampshades made of Jewish skin, but.
They weren't that creative back then, I guess.
Yeah, or shrunken heads, and, you know, I guess they didn't. Hollywood hadn't been established yet. C.D. Jackson, well, right. That crew.
They certainly accused him of being anti-Jewish, which, you know, to some extent may be true, but there was absolutely nothing in terms of policy. You know, Jews did very well in the Russian Empire. They were the dominant merchants in the country. The only other group that could really compete with them in that respect were the Old Believers. They were the rescuers of Christian Russia, at least in terms of the merchant classes.
Mm-hmm.
So there was nothing like this. They were very powerful men, even in St. Petersburg. So all this anti-Semitic stuff is absolute nonsense.
And also, to the extent that there was, bitterness or confrontation, it's often anti-Semitism is a, what's called anti-Semitism is a reaction to a behavior. And so obviously Jewish organizations are going to take a very self-serving, you know, view of history, these things, but they never ask about what type of behavior creates the acrimony. And this is why books like 200 Years Together by Alexander Solzhenitsyn has yet to be translated into English.
Yeah, there's bits and pieces that I've seen. I've translated pieces of it from my work,
mm-hmm.
But not the whole thing. Because Solzhenitsyn's, you know, the ruling class despised him. I mean, Gerald Ford refused to meet with him because he was afraid it would offend the Soviet leadership. You know, he came out not just against the Soviet system, but against American liberalism.
Yeah, he had that speech at Harvard University in 1978 when, he's not a fan of capitalism either.
And that doomed him. That yes. doomed him. They wanted a different thing. They brought in Joseph Brodsky. That was their favorite dissident,
mm-hmm.
and he was Jewish and liberal. Solzhenitsyn, but I've seen his FBI file, which has only recently been declassified. They were following him around. He was an enemy. There's absolutely no question about it. He all the white emigres who came to this country were seen as fascist sympathizers, like Ivan Illin and these people. I've done show after show on this. I've written so much on these guys. They've not been translated into English. They're brilliant men. It's a shame. My articles, you know, bring out a lot of these points, what kind of guys they were. You don't get exposure to this kind of stuff in the West. And the stuff that Westerners have written on Alexander Dugin, for example, is a joke. Horrible things. He was never an advisor to Putin. Where'd that come from? He never had a job in the Kremlin. He was in Moscow State as a sociologist. He had nothing to do. But yeah, every article says these are just Johnson's law. No one really knows anything, so they could say whatever they want.
Yeah, yeah. And and they can just, the press can, you know, pretty much spread whatever rumor and misinterpret or characterize his views, you know. An agent of Putin and these things.
It's been awful. Yeah. It's been awful. I've read everything, every book that man has written, which is no easy trick. He does nothing but write. He's like E. Michael Jones. These are huge books, you know, and he's a brilliant man. Few things I'm uncomfortable with him and the Eurasianists in general. But, of course, no one's perfect.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, I'm not perfect either. I'm occasionally wrong. That's what happens with anybody. But there is no understanding of Dugin in the ruling class intellectuals in this country whatsoever.
Well, you mentioned Putin kicking out the oligarchs. And the oligarchs, it was a class that was created by the West because they were the agents of London and Wall Street during the raping of Russia. And what we often refer to as the Russian Mafia, who are the Russian Mafia? And they're usually not Orthodox Christians, right?
Yeah, well, they're all Hindus, as we've already established. Russia's been raped more than once. Collectivization in the 30s, also very Jewish run. And the second Jewish run rape was in the 1990s. Jews began to remove themselves from Russian society in the 1970s. Russian industrialization had pretty much ground to a halt. It became very inefficient. They weren't changing over to newer methods. A lot of older, their capital was getting older and depreciating. And they didn't have the resources to really turn over. They never made that shift to light industry or consumer culture, for better or for worse. And heavy industry remained the order of the day, but that became very inefficient as time went on. The average mine in Ukraine is something like 1,000 feet. You know, very inefficient. But there were powerful lobbies that defended them. The profitability of these things went to zero in the 70s. Any loyalty to the so-called revolution had faded. You had guys like Brezhnev and Chernyanka and Andropov who were running the these were faceless, you know, these were just bureaucrats. And so the Jews began to turn on the Soviet Union.
This is the era of Jackson Vanek, right?
That's exactly what I'm getting to, right? Yeah. Jackson Vanek was the amendment that put some first time any sanctions were put on the Soviet Union, but only on if the Soviets kept Jews from immigrating to Israel.
So on behalf of international Jewry.
On behalf of Israel, is exactly right. Yeah. Of course, by then, even though the Soviets were the first to recognize Israel and had financed the Zionists early on, it became the U.S. was in a much better position to give them a much better deal, and it became an American, the U.S., you know, it was theirs, or the other way around. Either way, it wasn't so. And they ended up, the Soviets supported the Egyptians and the Syrians and the Iraqis. And so going to Israel meant, you know, going to the American side. And they began to lose it. So all of a sudden it became okay to be anti-communist in the 1970s. Because the Jews were abandoning it. And so by the time the system collapsed between 89 and 91, that's what got me into this field, because I was just a freshman in college. And it was just incredible how an empire could fall apart overnight without a war. That's why I signed up. I said, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. This is crazy. And they, with American help, I mean, this was organized by the U.S., the Justice Department sued Harvard University. Mm-hmm. I have an article on this. I don't know if you saw it. I think it was 2005. The Economics Department for misusing American government funds and destroying the Russian economy. It was all corrupt. The privatization system all went to their friends. And Russia was driven into poverty.
This was Jeffrey Sachs, Larry Summers.
Well, they weren't named in it, but Summers was the president at the time. Off the top of my head, I can't think of the main defendant who's still there. They defended even though he was convicted. He had to pay several $1 million in restitution, no problem. These guys were over there with USAID and really organizing the privatization program.
Yeah, the loans for shares, manipulation of the Russian bank, and
that's right.
They paid for Yeltsin's reelection, and you know,
right on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah,
you know, we saved them.
There's so much talk about Russian collusion and hacking elections, and then it turns out there's Time magazine saying, "Oh, we paid for his reelection."
His approval rating was like 6%.
Yeah,
at the time, there is no way this man was reelected. Honestly. Unfortunately, the opposition was so divided that they really never had. I mean, the communists were really the only people, and the Communist Party of the Soviet Union became the most conservative organization in the world. I mean, the communists now, you know, are Orthodox nationalists. They're Eurasianists.
Yeah, I can't believe it. They reject the culture of Marxism. You know, that's
totally.
That's de rigueur in the West now, right? So
totally. Zhuganov, so you're reading some great article about nationalism, and look at the top of the piece, and there's a hammer and sickle up there.
It's not worth doing. Well, you also talk about Stalin. You hear about Stalin's, you know, the doctor's plot, anti-Semitism. That's kind of a myth, right? About Stalin's anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I've written in my book that you just received, The Soviet Experiment. I've published this elsewhere too. Yes, Stalin was not a nationalist. He was not anti-Semitic. He was not pro-Christian. He was nothing of the kind. He enforced the death penalty for anti-Semitic incidents, which is right in Soviet law. Stalin went so far as to advocate an international language, which he was working on, starting from, you know, not just combining different languages of the world to create this new language when the revolution takes over every place.
Was he a Mason?
Not that I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. I don't think it would matter. He had enough power as it was.
Mm-hmm.
He was not Jewish. And I've actually written on this to some extent. DZU does not mean Jew in Georgian. The word would be Israeli. It is an odd name. That's true. He did marry Jews. Both his wives were Jews. His children all married Jews. He had tickets to the Yiddish theater. So he knew the language. So he was philo-Semitic entirely. He was an internationalist. He was a revolutionary in every way. Very briefly in 1944, he allowed the church some freedom to build the patriotic resistance to the Germans, and that was it. And so from that, think of it like this, and I've stated this many times. The American ruling class, the scholars that they hire, they're looking at Stalin purging the old Bolsheviks from the party. Almost everyone is Jewish. Well, they're faced with a choice. Either we admit that the Bolshevik Revolution was Jewish, or we say that he's an anti-Semite.
Yes, which is easier.
And so they picked the latter.
Yes.
And he was not. It just so happens that, of course, the Bolsheviks were all Jews. So when he purges the old party, they're mostly going to be Hindus, as we all know.
Yeah.
So that's what – so he was – no. I have him – you know, his works are not secret. His works are all in English online. He condemns this over and over again. He says that he supports the law that has a death penalty for anti-Semitic statements. No other group in Russia had that penalty attached to it. And as Solzhenitsyn says in 200 Years Together, Jews increased their representation in the bureaucracy, the government. Beria was a Jew. He was surrounded by Jews. That was the nature of the Soviet Union until the 70s.
Yeah, Kaganovich.
Kaganovich was one of the worst.
Yeah.
All these guys. Until the 70s, everything changes. It's not an accident that, you know, these guys were Andropov was a Jew. People don't realize that. Chernenko was not. But by then, the profitability had fallen, and Jews were, you know, shifting their allegiance elsewhere. And that's where Jackson Vanek comes from. But to answer your question, that's also where the Jewish mafia comes from.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from these people who had disengaged from the Soviet system. And if there was no profitability left in the system, then liquidating what was there was their only option. And that's what privatization was. It was their way of one last spit in the face of the Russian worker who they hated with a passion, taking everything that Russian workers had created over the last 50 years and putting it in their own pockets, mostly abroad, in New York and Swiss bank accounts.
Yeah, Brighton Beach, that area. And...
Exactly right. Yeah, yeah. And so when Putin comes to power, he has a problem. He throws out a lot of the major, Berezovsky goes into exile and stuff like this, goes to England, of course. But then he realizes that a huge portion of the Russian economy is abroad. So to some extent, he's got to play nice with some of these guys in order to bring some of this money back. He had no choice in the matter. But you've seen the video on YouTube. If you haven't, please go see it, where Putin marches in to Oleg Deripaska's aluminum factory in, I remember where it was. He was planning on closing shop and moving to Central Asia. And have you seen that? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, Vince. It kind of reminds me of Donald Trump and Carrier air conditioner and his speech during the campaign, keeping the factory in the United States. Yeah.
Well, the video, please go see. He marches into the place. He kicks the door open, like Clint Eastwood, and he says, "You're staying here, and this is how it's going to be, and you have one of the most richest men in the world." Deripaska, looking at him like a little puppy. He forces him to sign the paper that says he's going to stay. And as one last insult, Deripaska walks away. He says, "Give me back my pen." And that just as a way to show who's in charge. I've seen him at a medical supply factory that was accused of selling poor equipment. And he had a guy in a dentist chair. Now, he had a big smile on his face. Everyone knew he wasn't kidding. And this is what kind of a ruler he is. He's not going to tolerate second-rate stuff. This is why he's so damn popular. He took a Russia that was a fourth-world backwater in 1997. He comes in 2000, and now it's the world's seventh-largest economy, apparently controlling everybody's elections. by 2010, it's an empire again. That's extraordinary. I mean, how many leaders could do that? They went from nothing to a world power again. And remember, Russia, only about maybe 12% of the GDP comes from oil. Exports are different, but domestically, it's not an oil-based economy. It's a huge strategic element. The reason he arrested Khodorkovsky was that Khodorkovsky was on his way to sell the big Siberian oil fields to ExxonMobil. Now, this would have destroyed Russian independence in that industry. And he had his men stop the convoy, and he had them arrested. Now, of course, the guy hadn't paid taxes probably his whole life, so it was easy to get him on that, many other things, child labor and stuff like that. And so the West, of course, went bonkers. The West loves these men. They believe in oligarchy. And I've read the Wall Street Journal where oligarchs, they don't call them oligarchs, they call them tycoons. This is the future of Russia. This is democracy. This is everything else. And I was the very first guy in 2000 to say that Putin is one of us. I was condemned. I was at the Barnes Review in Spotlight at the time. I was condemned by everybody. He's KGB, he's Soviet, everything. I said, no, he's not. Watch what he's going to do. And I was absolutely condemned. Nobody on the right wing was saying that Putin was a good guy at the time. The right liked Yeltsin early on. I was the first one. I was the only one. I converted Willis Carter, who was my boss at the time, Michael Collins Piper, who I worked with every day. They ended up converting a whole bunch of other people, and that's how this whole Putin thing got started. I'm the one who got this started. I knew what he was. I knew what he was building, and the regime just waiting for any excuse to attack him.
You've pointed out in the essay the success of Nicholas II was you could prove that you could have a nationalist leader, a monarch, establish a society that is both progressive and egalitarian. Most people think that's a contradiction, a monarchy and egalitarianism. But as you point out, the idea of equality and democracy is a fraud too, because we have oligarchs ruling. But you say about the importance of killing Nicholas, what it means to Russia, because Nicholas is an icon. There's an iconoclasm involved in this murder, which maybe just explains so much of the violence. But you write, to destroy Russia, it was equally necessary to destroy its soul, and that's the monarchy. Be a loving family man wasn't just a matter of his personal preference. It was an icon both of political rule and the necessity of virtues for all society. It is these virtues precisely that both capitalism and communism loathe and despise. Modernity is killing of the king.
Well, I've done a broadcast many years ago. This is the 10th anniversary of my radio show. Again, these are just academic lectures that people apparently eat up. They're not exciting. It's just like a university classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I go through many different Republican systems, like late medieval Venice, and they're all based on this idea. The king is, of course, the man, the patriarch, represented by the number one. It's unity. It's strength. It's virtue. It's the land society. You mentioned the Eurasian concern with land versus sea powers. It's family and the nation as an extended family. A ruler can't rule a country if he can't rule himself. So he has to. This is something that Tsar Nicholas really was concerned with, as was his father. The court life in Russia and every other monarchy is notoriously immoral. Masonry penetrated it, unfortunately, and he was aware of this. Liberalism had taken over much of the nobility, who were fading in power. There were some of them bureaucrats, some were elites in urban areas, and he had to fight this with every bit of strength he had. Now, Alexander III was more intimidating and did absolutely incorruptible man, and he did this very well. Tsar Nicholas II struggled with it. But everyone knew that he was rejecting this, you know, the results of being an elite, these temptations getting to everybody, and he was at war with this. And this is part of his job. This is what part of ruling is. Society is ruled by custom and tradition. A monarch is a religious figure. His job is to be what celebrities are today, a role model, an icon. And you're absolutely right to use that term. That's exactly what he wants. And he named his son Alexis because Tsar Alexei, Michael's son, just after the time of troubles in Russia, was his model. And he saw himself as a religious figure. The religious tradition, he's an icon of what a man should be, the connection between heaven and earth, the manifestation of natural law. And if he didn't represent that, then in no way did he have any legitimacy to rule anybody. And that was the constitution in his mind. And this is why he's a saint. It's not just because he was a martyr and murdered for the faith. Of course he was. But it was because of how he lived. And his whole family lived that way. Alexander Kerensky, one of his agents came to him and said, we want to publish the correspondence between the two, husband and wife, thinking that he's going to humiliate them. It was all in English, by the way, so he had to have it translated. And Kerensky said, no, if we do this, everyone's going to think they're saints. I mentioned in the book that after Nicholas was removed from power through fraud, I mean, he did not abdicate, and it's all a lie, the white government created the Extraordinary Commission. The point was to find all the corruption that existed in the Tsarist system. And they had access to everything. They went through stuff on Rasputin. They went through stuff on all members of the royal family. And they came to the conclusion that there was nothing they could say. Everything, all their propaganda was a lie. And they actually admitted this. And the Extraordinary Commission came to the conclusion that all this stuff about Rasputin was mythology. All this stuff about corruption in the royal family was mythology. They couldn't even find corruption, even in mid-level bureaucrats. And this comes from, there's no greater proof than this. These guys had every reason to find problems. They had access to every bit of paper that ever came out of St. Petersburg. And yet they had to admit, we got nothing here. He was a great and extraordinary man. And so many of these guys ended up converting to that side, realizing that they had made a gigantic mistake. Now, how many rulers could survive an inquiry like that? And they went through everything. And this is something I can't stress this enough. They found nothing. It was an extraordinary moral or ruling class. And that's only because, not just of Nicholas II, but his father, Alexander III. And why this commission? Let me read. I have it right in front of me. Let me read the conclusion to the EIC here. It turns out that the supreme power in the last months of the old regime itself gradually delegated parts of their sovereign rights to the hands of ministers of senior officials. All of his comrades lived under the old regime and knew what was being done. We all think something terrible is happening in the police department. You know, in all fairness, it should be not as it is in the depraved imagination of the Russian people, but what was really there? In front of me is a document, is the Magna Carta of the police department to its lawlessness. This document is the instruction on the organization and conduct of internal supervision of the gendarme investigative offices. Entire generations who gave themselves to the police had a hand in the creation of this manual. All of them gradually perfect this system. Rudnev, who was the head of it, goes on to explain in great detail that they were simply wrong about that. That was about the police department, but this is, they admitted there was absolutely nothing that these guys had done. And the fact that Rasputin was completely still hasn't trickled down to the average professor of Russia studies in American universities. The man was not what he was accused to be. And really the whole history of the early 20th century has to be redone.
Yeah, definitely. A reevaluation, a revision is long overdue in these things. Under a monarchical orthodox, system, that's a check on oligarchy. I think you correctly identify Protestantism kind of opening the floodgates to this, to the rise of capitalism. And of course, capitalism liberates the merchant class or the wealthy from the constraints of the church, of religious morality, and the market becomes the only judge in these things. So that's the attraction that I think the Freemasonry has to ideas of liberty and economic freedom, and these things doing away with the constraints of traditional society. You write, an Orthodox man must be a monarchist. Can you expand on that? It's interesting.
Well, in so many of the writings of the old saints, modern as well as ancient, this is God's design for man. In no way do they ever support anything like republicanism or any kind of democracy. Now, Russia had a lot of local democracy. It was far more democratic than any other country. What really mattered at the county level, at the commune level, they were everything, including the policemen, were elected. So to be an Orthodox man, this is a matter of doctrine. After the time of trouble, 1613, all the elites of Russia came to elect a new czar, which is where the Romanov line first started, Michael, and they swore for eternity that they will be loyal to the monarchy of Russia and that this is the Orthodox form of government. And of course, they mentioned King David. And some of the good kings, not Solomon for obvious reasons, but good monarchs after him. And this was and David is the model for Christian government. And there's no question about it. There is no right to be anything else. Monarchy is a picture of heaven. It's an icon of heaven. The monarch is a religious figure. He's meant to be a role model far more than a lawgiver. Traditional societies don't make law. They clarify law. They uncover law. You can't make a law. Law is part of the natural order. You don't pass legislation. You only clarify it and make it more relevant to present conditions. In my opinion, and the opinion of many Orthodox people, including St. Philaret and many others, it is heresy to believe in republicanism or democracy as the acceptable political system.
Yet that is seems to be the ruling ideology today, even among today's Pope has endorsed separation of church and state, and republicanism as the ideal form of government, which even based on Catholic traditional teaching is wrong. And so it's completely contradictory to the ideas of the modern world. But again, the modern world pretty much is one big Masonic lodge. Would you agree?
I think it's a factory producing sin. It uses male sexual desire to control how we spend our money, how we view ourselves. And E. Michael Jones, as you know, in Monsters from the Id and Libido Dominandi, explains this in great detail. That's what modernity is. It's a way to control people using their passions. It's the lowest common denominator. And, of course, monarchy was the exact opposite. Sometimes when we debate people, you know, who believe in republicanism, they attack monarchy for their mistakes, you know, real life things that happen. But whenever they refer to republicanism, they refer purely to ideal types.
Yes, great point.
Always do that. It's a fallacy. They can't do that. You know, real monarchy, real republicanism. How did those two systems behave in legislation and everything else? You can't use this ideal, and Marxists do this all the time with socialism, the no true Scotsman fallacy. Whenever a socialist says, oh, the Soviet Union wasn't real socialism, say, okay, the U.S. wasn't real capitalism. You know, it's such a dishonest way to debate. We talk about how these systems actually ruled, not the ideal system it's based on. This is why I mentioned the Extraordinary Commission.
Yeah, you do get an argument when you talk about absolute monarchy. That's what the czarist regime is often called, was absolute monarchy. And then he gradually gives them the Duma, and it's edging towards constitutional monarchy. Then the war starts, and then there's the revolution. That's what we're given. But what they'll say is that you're advocating monarchy. You're advocating, you know, more or less a dictatorship with incense and the trappings of religion and these things. But really, as you point out, there is much more accountability in traditional society under a monarch than there is under a Freemasonic republic, where we have the trappings of rule of law. We have bureaucracy that's completely unaccountable for the most part to the average citizen, just entangling bureaucracies and tax laws and regulations, not to mention just corruption. How, you know, we don't have rule of law. We have judges that do the bidding of the oligarchs in their interpretation of the law. So you have a government which, yeah, it has a constitution, but it doesn't follow it. Obviously, it doesn't follow the constitution.
Well, the American Constitution was written at a time, first of all, it was a hodgepodge of different compromises. No one was really satisfied with it. Mm-hmm. The Anti-Federalists refused to sign, which includes Patrick Henry and guys like that.
Yeah, I smell a rat.
Yeah, certainly. A whole lot. George Mason wouldn't sign it.
Yeah.
And people know this. They refer to the Founding Fathers as this unified group, this mystic college of lawgivers. And you know, they fought one another over everything. It was a hodgepodge. It wasn't. But back then, you didn't have mass media. You didn't have economic conglomerates. You didn't have globalization. You didn't have massive standing armies in the U.S. You didn't have control by aliens. You didn't have the use of immigration to remove people. You had none of this stuff. The ideologies, the Constitution doesn't have any bearing on today's society. It treats, or at least the law, treats corporations as people, which means not only can you not regulate them, they have freedom of speech, just like. Well, you know, when Warren Buffett speaks, it's a lot more important than when I speak. You know, yeah. It gives this fake view of equality. And the only individuals that matter are those who have money.
Yeah, the dollar democracy.
That's all. And media attention. You can't get elected to an office unless the media likes you and promotes you. Otherwise, you don't exist.
Yeah, there's someone said, if you believe in the theory of democracy, you believe that, Yeah, your vote matters as much as David Rockefeller's, you know, when David Rockefeller was still around. And that's obviously not true. Money counts, right? And especially when you can have 90% of the media controlled by five or six corporations. Most of the people who run those corporations belong to the same group.
Hindus.
Yes, those Hindus.
Yeah, they're Sikhs. You know. Well, I've never voted. I'm quite proud of that fact. I've never seen the inside of a voting booth. I have no idea what it looks like, which means I've never served on a jury. And I do it to make a very important point. I'm not going to be a part of this. If you vote, you bear a small bit of responsibility for what happens. But even beyond that, policy isn't made by politicians. Well, you know, when you have, if these guys are usually too busy campaigning or working on local projects. You have bills like NAFTA that were 5,000 pages long. The Omnibus Crime Bill of 94 was like 10,000 pages long. You think they read it? You think they sat down and took notes on it? No, they do what they're told. They do what the whips tell them to do.
We have to pass it to know what's in it, right?
Nancy Pelosi. Oh, yeah, that was Pelosi's comment, yeah.
And that law was written by the insurance company. I think it was like Elizabeth Fowler, I think, was the one that really wrote it. And she worked. She was the vice president of marketing for WellPoint. Then she went, I guess she temporarily went to the Senate to write the bill, then went back to the insurance industry.
Well, I have to admit, I mean, Obamacare did benefit me. I did get a subsidized plan. However, it was just a giveaway to, you know, you're forcing people to take out insurance policies. And I guess that was a way to compensate for them not permitting any prior condition restrictions. So they said, okay, we're going to make sure people have to buy one. The marketplace wasn't a bad idea. I have to admit that. But that's not really the core of the thing.
Yeah.
You know, I have, the healthcare system. But as we know, the increase in healthcare costs is driven by mental illness. About half the drugs and everything else that are driving up costs are from mental illnesses. It's from the nature of the society that's causing the problem.
Yeah, it's interesting when you point up that mental illness, or whatever that means, by the way. I think it's sort of a spiritual despair in many respects. Yeah. Was very low in under Imperial Russia.
Yeah, well, you notice that when you, to the extent you have accurate records, and Russians were pretty strong German medical corps, was very loyal to the Tsar. They had a very good, if you read Anton Chekhov, the great writer, who was an MD himself, you had substantial medical establishment there. Authoritarian religious governments don't see very much divorce. They don't see very much mental illness. You see it where you promote individualism, and the individual comes to realize that he doesn't matter. That what individualism really is to the capitalist system is ruled by your passions, which is the worst form of slavery.
Yes.
Addiction to sex, not to mention, or greed, or what people think of you, and of course, debt. The so-called prosperity of America after World War II is debt-driven. That means it's based on nothing.
And that funded consumerism.
Yeah, and which is coming to an end because there's simply no more credit to be given. When the banks were bailed out, this was a turning point for me. After the 2008 crash, these banks, the same banks that had foreclosed on millions of homes, the government then turns around and says to these same people, you have to now bail them out and not take any ownership in them. You think if they were bailed out by the taxpayer, we would have partial nationalization. That would make sense. But not only do you have the day before close on your home, now you have to bail them out. And I don't know if you've read recently, the subprime mortgage stuff is back. Mm-hmm. They've learned nothing. Capitalism is not a rational system because people aren't rational. And liberal democracy and capitalism, the free market, is based on reason. It's based on people being rational individuals. And they're not.
They're unguided reason, right? That's the hubris of the Enlightenment, right?
Yeah, people develop their opinions based on anything but reason. You know, I made a decision back in college. I remember the day that I wasn't going to allow self-interest or any external force to dictate what I thought, which, by the way, I wish I never did, because it's been a very difficult life. Try to be honest all the time. just try to live a week never telling a lie. Oh my God, it's horrible. You know, it's so easy to fall into this. The average American owes more than he possesses, therefore he possesses nothing. So they are a true proletariat. That you can't. You know, if you owe the average debt, the average household is something like $15,000, $15,000 to $20,000. or more. That's just credit cards. It's actually much higher than that. Private sector debt is as big as state debt. They're about $17 trillion each. There are enough dollars in the world to pay that. And of course, interest continues to build up. It's horrifying. But I made a decision that I wasn't going to allow self-interest. And it's been, I think I stuck to it. You can never do that perfectly. But I was concerned with truth. And I spent my life, in college and grad school, all those years, slaving away in difficult texts and everything else, only to learn when I go out into the real world that no one cares. No one cares about the truth. The truth is not an important category. Important categories are what makes me feel good, what justifies my lifestyle, what I want to hear. That matters. John Stuart Mill stated that the free speech is necessary because it's a marketplace of ideas. False ideas will fall away and the true ones will remain. Well, that assumes that people care about the truth, that they want to know the truth, that this is their primary reason for doing or saying anything, and that they know what their interest is. And none of that is true. And the economy is absolute proof of that. These policies, people who really rule society, media, all kinds of, all the corporate, all the conglomerates, no one knows anything about these guys. Tech companies that control what's being said, what's not being said on Facebook or they're far more powerful than the state. Microsoft proved that they could take on the state and win. They have more money. They have more lawyers than the Justice Department does. Microsoft doesn't fear the government. The U.S. government depends on banks to loan it money to function. That means the banks rule the government. So when Bernie Sanders talks about regulating banks, I laugh. No. In America, the government doesn't regulate banks. Banks regulate the government.
Yeah, that's what the Federal Reserve is all about.
Exactly. Politicians are there so that elite billionaires can have someone to blame when things go badly.
Yeah, they're the managers, but yeah, they're the people to the lightning rod for criticism, sort of.
That's what they're there for, yeah. And people actually believe that presidents have something to do with economies. The Reagan boom, the Clinton boom. Oh, is he making investment decisions? What sort of directors is he sitting on?
Yeah, you hear about that. The Nixon shock, the Ford, the Ford Carter recessions and these things. And then if you do a little research or studying these events, the economy is responding to decades of policy decisions that are taken, and the sitting president's not going to have much say in what happens. And then they're also at the, they're going to rely on the Federal Reserve with interest rate manipulations to keep the economy booming and, the petrodollar, these things intact. And a sitting president's not going to be able to take on the intelligence agencies and the financial interests that ultimately the intelligence agencies work for. They created them. I mean, for Pete's sake. Wall Street created, OSS and CIA, right.
And with very few politicians simply are knowledgeable. I don't know how many you've met. They're really a sad bunch of guys.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. They really are. And to these, whenever I met a politician that I was kind of impressed with talking to him, it's always from a small country.
I'm just talking about congressmen, senators, local guys. Oh, these guys—they're businessmen. They're actors. They're putting on a show.
And they're waiting to become lobbyists.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Now the Federal Reserve. Banks, conglomerates, NBC, that's power.
But this is our democracy, doctor. This is our democracy.
I'm a heretic.
But this goes back to what I was saying before, is who checks these mega corporations, transnationals, mega corporations that are kind of, I guess you could say, the true Illuminati, I guess if you want to use that term, is if you have a monarchy, a state, that's united with a church, symphonia, I think is the term, a confessional state, something like the Franco regime,
great man, up until
the 70s. But look, he's been sullied, his reputation. But look what happened to Spain under liberal democracy. Look what it's turned into.
Well, it is the first 10 years. Now, Francisco Franco When I first started college, the very first political book I ever read was a biography of Franco by Stanley Payne. And Stanley Payne actually does an amazing job. The economy exploded under Franco, especially in the auto industry.
He kept them out of the war. I mean, talk about
out of the war and out of the Cold War. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was very, very successful. And yet there were sanctions on his government. He was called every name in the book then and now.
And the Catholic and Church abandoned him.
Yeah, well, he always struggled with them. I mean, he struggled with the church even early on. But Franco was one of the great men of the 20th century. There's no doubt in my mind.
That's, again, another person to reevaluate. Because look at Spain adopted the liberal constitution a couple years after his death. And then now you have negative birth rates. Homosexuality is rampant. All the degenerate Western stuff is throughout Spain. They have gay parades during Holy Week in Spain, and it appears to be suffering, sort of a secular decline. And you can see that throughout the West, because the West loses its faith and its cult, and there's no reason to live anymore.
And this is mental illness. Spain went from one of the great empires in the world to really a third world country, and that's very sad. When I taught my Renaissance to Enlightenment class at Mount St. Mary's, which I taught many times, my final exam was one question. And this question was considered so good that other professors stole it. It's still being asked today. The question was, describe the world if the Spanish were the victors in the Spanish Armada. And of course, what would the world look like today? Now, of course, all my exams were take home. I'm not going to read their damn handwriting. And the kids did really well. They loved it. Some talked about banking, some talked about economics, some talked about food. Of course, it would be a completely different world. That was the dividing line. Now the English liberals dominated the seas. But that's what Spain was back then, the world's great power. And now, as a part of the EU, it's a beggar state.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, Charles Colum writes about that in his book, Puritan's Empire.
And he does I like him. I've quoted him many times.
Yeah, reevaluating, he points out, there was a whole civilization that predates, the English and then the French, but it was the Spanish Empire, and just the culture it created throughout Latin America. And much of the subversion and revolutions were actually stirred up from outside by the British. And what would have happened if Spanish culture, if the United States actually stuck by the terms of the Treaty Hidalgo Guadalupe, and that the influence of Catholic Spanish culture on American culture, it would have been interesting to see what would have happened in its influence on American culture and checking the forces of Freemasonry and things like that. So it's very interesting. It's a different outlook.
Phone calls from other professors saying, that was the most incredible question I've ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
That encapsulates the entire course. It encapsulates it. It's perfect. And of course, everyone knows what the answer is. And it's very uncomfortable for people who believe in liberal democracy and capitalism.
Yeah, because you wouldn't have had slavery than wage slavery.
Yep.
That we got in the West. Because even Michael Jones writes about that in Baron Metal, the efforts of the Jesuit reductions in Paraguay, and their efforts with the Guaranis, and how the this is dramatized the movie The Mission.
I've got to get this book. Someone please send this book to me.
They're not cheap.
I know.
How they were shut down but he says Freemasonic influences within the Portuguese and Spanish government. This is infiltration again. This is why these issues are complicated, because we have these blurred lines. We don't have states, we can support and not support. It's not that distinct, unfortunately, so it complicates the matter. But they were teaching the Guaranis. They taught them a language, a written language. It exists today. It's the official language of Paraguay. But this gave them logos, an identity that could survive with the written language. This is the efforts of the Jesuits, when the Jesuits were good. And one thing also, they taught them agriculture and rudimentary manufacturing. so much so they started to export their goods, like I think like violins and things like that. But the point is that this would contradict the economic hitman slave model that would be sort of the model of development in the West with under English rule, and so it was shut down and they were sold off into slavery, and the rest is history, as they say.
The British model was based on slavery and imperialism, and then of course wage slavery and capitalist imperialism, and now kind of soft imperialism, media control afterwards.
Yeah,
it's a disastrous model.
And it's this, here's the Nicholas II shows that a strongly nationalistic, royalist, and statist politics can grow an economy on a massive scale while it still preserves egalitarian principles and social justice, and maintains moral sanity. We're not seeing that in the West.
Are you quoting me there?
That's you. I'm sorry. Yes, that's you.
Oh, okay. I don't remember.
You wrote that.
Well, yeah, I meant every word of it. And you know, wherever that kind of social nationalism has been tried, whether it be in Belarus, China, South Korea under General Park, Hitler in the 30s, it's been a huge – Franco, it's been a gigantic success. You compare that to liberal regimes, what's happened when countries come under the EU. This fact is that the state has to be stronger than capital. In the West, capital controls the state. In China and Russia, the state, for the moment, is strong enough to control capital. That's the absolutely essential thing, because the state maintains some sense of the common good. And someone like General Park in South Korea, who, again, one of the few guys who turned a fourth world backwater into a first world country in 9 years, and was a national socialist. I mean, the U.S. tilted to the North Koreans under him. People don't know this. The Pueblo setup and all this stuff. I have an article on this, a broadcast on this. General Park, the U.S. tried to assassinate him many times. When he was finally assassinated in 79, the assassin just before his execution said that he met with the American ambassador just an hour before he went to kill him. And this is the man who built South Korea. And they were actually tilting, being pro-North for a short period of time when he was ruling. That's how far the regime will go to fight any real kind of social nationalist strong leadership in a nation.
Yeah. Any alternative model.
It's a threat. Right in the American Defense Doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
If you read the from the Department of Defense, it says so explicitly. It says China is an ideological threat to the U.S., very explicitly.
And what's strange is it was the elites that helped us create the China that it is today.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the opium wars, then the Mao, these things, and Rockefeller loved Mao, then became a state capitalist. Like, I guess it goes to prove, these things can be set up. They don't control everything. So,
right.
people go off plan, and they have to be, they go rogue or start to mark out their own independence in these things.
Well, there are reasons to be optimistic. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is the most important organization on the planet, politically speaking. And we know this because no one's talking about it. It's a Russo-Chinese anti-liberal, anti-American front that now includes Iran. They've made, and believe it or not, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Belarus, and now the coup of all coups, Turkey. Turkey leaving NATO.
Yeah, Turkey's in NATO.
This is unreal. This is unbelievable. This is why the U.S., they could posture all you want. I have an article out on the condition of the U.S. Navy. It's literally falling apart. The corruption is so bad at the Pentagon.
Trillions have been missing, right? No one knows.
Well, they hired – there's a law called the Audit the Pentagon Law.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty clear as to what its intent was. It's never been followed because they hired Ernst & Young, the famous New York City auditing firm, to go in there. And they said after several years of trying, we can't. There are no records. No one wants to cooperate with us. We can't audit these people. That's how bad the corruption is. No idea how much money they have. They have no idea where it goes. That's how bad things are. They simply gave up and said, I don't care how much money you give us, we can't audit a company that is unauditable. That's how bad it is for these guys. This is what happens when you're given trillions of dollars a year. The real defense budget is more than $1 trillion a year. And still 80% of the elite fighters in the Navy can't fly. Half the carriers are struggling.
Yeah,
it's literally
the F-35, right? Can't fly in the rain.
Yeah, it is a disaster. I don't know how many. I mean, every other day there's a plane crashing. There's a Navy, a destroyer crashing into a fishing boat. What the hell is going on here? I mean, affirmative action is part of it. The total lack of morale is part of it. Because these guys are getting trillions of dollars, and of course they all say, we're not getting enough money. They're like the teachers' union.
Yeah, the pilot was probably transgendered and nails were too long or something.
Yeah, and you know, the head of the Green Berets has completely, you know, they're not an elite group anymore. This guy, if you go to militarycorruption.com, this guy has completely remade it. Can't think of his name off the top of my head. Standards have been lowered all over the place. This is what's happening. They're losing people. The Air Force, you know, they're 800 pilots short right now. You know, Russians can rest easy. So could the Chinese. When a country can shoot back, the U.S. can't win.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It hasn't fought a country that can shoot back since 1945.
Well, I mean, and they're defeated anyway.
Yeah.
Negotiating with the Taliban on the terms of surrender to get out of Afghanistan. They were defeated in Somalia. The government that the U.S. created in Iraq has just demanded they leave. Their own public government said, get out of here. And a lot of the reason is the crimes of the American soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that, you know, that the world rests on their shoulders, and they're getting beaten everywhere. And they're so – I mean, I've done article after article on how overpaid Air Force officers are. These guys are getting huge amounts of money. And plus, their sign-on bonuses are gigantic. And they think they're gods. And yet, most of the planes can't fly. A lot of the ships can't function. What they found with the nuclear missile bases in America, the lack of training, it's frightening. The U.S. is a paper tiger. They don't have the money. They don't have the men. They don't have the political will. They don't have the backbone to fight a country like Iran or China that has a reason to fight, who's done nothing wrong. And they will defeat any attempt of the U.S. to try to flex its muscles. I mean, my God, it wasn't that long ago where they were talking about light, low-megaton nuclear weapons to use against Iran.
Yeah.
This isn't a strong country talking like this. This is a weak, wounded animal backed into a corner, and it's going to lash out, and that's what it's doing. It's defeated. I've used the metaphor of the U.S. and the world is like a very rich man who used to run a huge company who loses all his money and yet still goes to work every day, starts ordering people around, hasn't dealt with the fact that he lost his money, has no power. No one listens to him. Everyone laughs at him. That's what's going on now. When Turkey abandons NATO to go to China and all the NATO secrets are now there, it's over. The French are not going to fight any war. The Germans have already said they're not going to enforce any of the sanctions against Russia. It's over. It's over for the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I think 44% of the nations on the earth are under U.S. economic sanctions. How do you maintain the world's reserve currency when you're doing that? People are just going to get out from under it. Not going to deal with it. You know,
you don't. Yeah, the German government can't go to Mercedes-Benz and say, "Yeah, we're going to take, you know, don't invest in Russia anymore."
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
I'm sorry. Yeah, take us to court, see what happens. It's never going to happen. And the French have already said that they've left NATO twice already. And the most successful countries in Europe are Hungary and Poland, and we know why. And I remember when the Poles, when they were condemned for not taking the so-called migrants from North Africa, they said, well, excuse me, we've taken several thousand migrants from the civil war in eastern Ukraine. And they were told, and I quote, they weren't the right color.
Gee, someone's agenda there?
A little bit. All the Hindus. They're concerned with these.
Because the obvious place to put people from North Africa or sub-Saharan Africa is Poland or Finland, right? That's the obvious place you put people, or Minnesota for that matter, right?
Yeah, the minute they get there, they're Finns.
Well, this is it. I mean, you know, under democracy, we're given this paper constitutions and quote rule of law, and we can vote, but there's no adults in charge. But at least with a monarchy, there's a chance that you'll have an adult in charge that can kind of keep these things from happening, or at least regulate them better in the interest of the people.
This is why Putin is so popular.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they know that the economic recovery under him, he's a very, very popular man, and they trust him. And they want him to keep ruling the country, even if it means they have to violate the Constitution and term limits to do it. And they said this many times, poll after poll after poll. So, again, I'll say it again, and I'll conclude with this statement, and it's very important for me to say it over and over again. Everything that the average American believes about the world is mythology.
Yes, so now it's time to start research, crack a few books, and start finding out what really is going on.
And send me a few dollars in the process, please.
Yes. So to support your work, how can people do that?
Well, you mentioned my website already, mm-hmm. rushjournal.org. You can donate directly to my through PayPal on there. After my divorce and other debts, you know, I declared bankruptcy. I really desperately need the cash. And because this is a full-time job, you cannot do this part-time. Present company accepted, of course. but for real deep scholarship in a very specialized area, this is a full-time job. And that means without any university or church or think tank or government supporting me, I need the generosity of my listeners. And they have been generous. And because they know they're getting a very original, very high quality product. My predictions have a tendency to come true. And I have a strong fan base. And I just ask, and it's very hard for me. You know, my father was a relatively wealthy man. He didn't die a wealthy man, but you know, I come from some money, and it's very hard for me to ask for money. It's humiliating, but I have no choice anymore.
Well, you provide a service.
I used to give everything away for free. But now I can't do that anymore.
Yeah. So you have to appreciate that. This stuff takes time, and you have to keep the lights on, pay for groceries in the meantime. Yeah.
Believe it or not, you have to pay the internet bill. There's no question about it.
Yes.
And I have four cats that rule the house, and if I don't feed them, they're going to kill me. So my life's at stake here, please.
You don't want hungry cats in your house, that's for sure.
They are anarchists. They're not a member of a party or anything, but one of them just jumped on my desk right now. Because she knows I'm talking about her. So, you know, please, for their sake.
For the cats.
Well, they run the show here.
Okay, well, hey, well, thank you, Doctor. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, the author of Circle of Betrayal, Cowardice and Deceit, an essay on the 100th anniversary of the ritual murder of the Russian royal family. It's an important revisionist piece. Of scholarship. It's not long. It's very an easy read, but it will challenge what you think. Like you said, so much of what we think, I mean, most of what we think of what's gone on in history, how the world works, is false. And this is a good book to read to getting a revisionist view of these events and appreciation of what really occurred. Of course, your latest book, The Soviet Experiment, Challenging the Apologists for Communist Tyranny, is out now, so I encourage people to get that. I've already purchased a copy. And after I read this, I'd like to have you back on and discuss this book.
Yeah, it's published by the Barnes Review.
Mm-hmm.
I was editor for a while. They published three of my nine books. And yeah, you can have me on anytime. It's been absolutely great.
Thank you.
I hope your listeners appreciate me.
Great. I'll post this soon. I do. I'll send you the link.
Thank you very much, my friend.
Great. Good night, then.
Bye.